Hi, Zach. Can you hear me? It's Gene Simmons.
I can hear you loud and clear. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
How's the legal team?
Well, once they're gone, all is well. The more time somebody is there, the clock keeps ticking.
Are you busier than ever post-kiss, or are things slowing down a little bit?
No, it's busier now.
Really? Why is it busier now?
Well, you may have read. Or not. There's a terrific company called Pop House, who are responsible for that ABBA Avatar show in
Yes.
London, outside of London, which has pulled millions of tickets actually, and is quite a thing. But even that technology is now yesterday's news. So we sold the band, the underlying rights, if you will. And so they're going to be, before you know it, there'll be, I don't know how to describe it, but so far we're just calling it Kiss Avatars. It'll be seen around the world. And I'll try to describe it. When you put on virtual glasses, you get a 360 degree experience wherever you turn your head. You're in that universe. You're in another more parallel universe, if you will. You could be in the land of dinosaurs or falling off a cliff, or God knows, you pick your head up to the sky and you see the sky. And you lower your chin and you look like a chasm with your feet falling, in the thing. So you actually believe, to the extent that you sh shut off your mind, that you're actually in that world. Now imagine not wearing glasses and having that experience.
How much
It's,
is it? Because I've seen the ABBA experience in London. Is it
yeah.
going to totally blow that away?
It already does, yeah.
And is
It's
there,
like when they're new generations, technology, I'm sure you keep up with it, is growing by leaps and bounds. It's not just chat. GPT, XYZ, LOL, PT, IOU, as soon as they put more letters. But it's also, the future is here. AI now fixes itself and teaches itself. And so the technology has advanced by leaps and bounds, even where the ABBA show was. You could swear ABBA was live on stage. But you have to look straight forward. If you look to the left or right, you can see your neighbor sitting behind you or next to you. And so you have that kind of, oh, this is reality, and what's on stage looks like reality. But as you know, with 3D glasses, virtual glasses, your sense of what's real and what's not is skewed. So there's all that. So the answer is yes, we're busy working on that. We've already filmed motion capture way up in San Francisco at George Lucas's place. But aside from that, I've got the Gene Simmons band, which has already played Europe. I'm going to go back out in America for about 30 shows, outdoors and indoors. Almost, well, so far, headlining all of them, including a festival or two. And then a film company called Simmons Hamilton. You can Google and schmoogle it. The first movie coming shortly is Deep Water, an action thriller with Sir Ben Kingsley and Aaron Eckhart. Director is Rennie Harlan, and a second movie right after that. And they're both done. They're just in post edit. Then there's a restaurant chain called Rock and Brews, BREWS.
I see
Dot
that in
com.
every airport.
Yeah, doing very well. And so many other sort of ventures, it would be difficult to keep up because they have nothing to do with each other. So the long-winded answer is yes, busier than ever.
Gene, I was watching this video a couple hours ago of you and the legendary bass player Carole K, and she's almost giving you a lesson. I don't know if that was the intention of that hang together, but she's showing you something. Do you remember what she was teaching you, and were you trying to learn something from her, or what was that interaction that is on YouTube?
Well, here's where it came from. I was the voice, the narrator for, believe it or not, a hip hop documentary. The premise being that the beginnings of hip hop had to do with the early hip hoppers sampling a song called Apache by the Bongo Doodah Band, something like that. It's just the guy who was my partner in the publishing venture, Simmons Comics, Michael Viener, who was not musical at all, put together this little studio group, and you had an idea about a feeling, kind of a rhythmic thing, which was a minor hit, but for whatever reason, early hip hop sampled a lot of that. So on early Fat Boys and Run DMC and all that stuff, you hear it, Grandmaster Flash and all that. So I was in the studio, recording studio in LA, to do some last minute overdubs. Carol was there as well. So here's a little brief synopsis of Carol. When you hear the Four Tops and Sonny and Cher and Frank Sinatra and Nat King Cole and everybody, she was the bass player, sometimes the guitarist. But her bass playing was revered so much in the what's called the Wrecking Crew. They were the secret musicians who played on all those Birds, Paul Revere and the Raiders, anybody, Frank Sinatra, everybody. That, for instance, The Beat Goes On by Sonny and Cher. The most memorable thing about that is actually the bass line. Bum, 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 bum. And that's what Carol did. She would come up with these bass licks that, you know, in and of themselves were certainly hooks, memorable. She played on Four Tops, other Motown artists, and so on. When people mostly perceive of James Jamerson, the iconic bass player, being that. But no, she's this small Jewish blonde woman who Americanized her name, K-K-Y-E, who played on all those things. So she happened to be there, and she had a bass with her. And I walked up and introduced myself. I'm a big fan. What you did, you know, in the early days was amazing and stuff. Would you mind playing for me? I wanted to see it firsthand because, you know, I can play. And she played, you know, something like that. And I tried to show off. And I remember saying, here, let me try that. I think I can do that. And I thought in my mind, I knew all the notes. I knew where the fingers went. So I thought I reproduced it. And immediately she said, no, 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 that's not it. And grabbed the bass and did it again. I couldn't tell the difference. I said, let me try it again. And I played it again. She said, no, no, no. Well, what's the problem? She said, you are playing the notes, but you're not playing the feeling. The only analogy I could make is when you see a Shakespearean actor reading the words of Shakespeare and you go, oh, I could do that. So you pick up the Shakespearean play and you actually wind up saying those words, but you're not emoting. You don't have the feeling. Those words mean nothing in your mouth, even though they're exactly the same words as a Shakespearean actor is saying, if you see what I mean.
Did you get a sense at the end of it of what she was trying to get at? Or the whole time you go, I can't tap into this specific thing?
I got closer. I got closer. But you never know if the feeling is right, because everything that you hear or you see is about feelings, how you feel about it. So I got closer, but you never really know until you hear the full musical canvas, drums, keyboards, vocal, and stuff. And then you see whether or not the puzzle fits.
Do you think that the character of Gene Simmons overshadows the fact that you're actually, I think, a phenomenal bass player? Do you think you get enough credit for being a great bass player?
It honestly doesn't mean anything to me.
Really? Because is that not what you set out to do? Was the base just a tool to get everything else?
Well, there's the why question, and then what did you set out to do? The why question is that I'm comfortable in my own skin. I know how good I am, and I know my shortcomings, and what other people have to say about it is, well, they're unqualified to have an opinion. They haven't been there and they haven't done that. So, and I listen, I appreciate people's point of view, but it doesn't pierce my thick skin. It doesn't mean anything. The why did you do this? Well, the real answer is I did it for the same reason that Springsteen and everybody else did it in our younger years, even though they don't admit it, is because initially you wanted the chicks and then you wanted the money. And then there was a split. Some artists thought they were, you know, I have the secret life, or I want to be deep and poetic and credibility and all that stuff. But initially, we all did it for the same reason. Otherwise, we would have all gotten our dentist or plumber's license and did that. But chicks don't care if you're a good plumber.
But there wasn't, was really the only reason was because I guess you saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan and you just thought that that was a path, but there was no, or maybe I'm sure there was, but how deep was the love for the actual music? Or was that really not it when, you know, that motivated you to get into this?
Well, of course I love the music and, but people don't understand that initially when you fall in love with a band or an artist, you're actually listening with your eyes. And that's worth slowing down and saying that so that it gets digested. You think music, almost by definition, is just supposed to tickle your ears. But that's not actually what happens. What happens is first, your ears start to tingle because you're hearing things that you like, in my case, the Beatles. But then if somehow it connects with the visuals, then something magical happens. You become a fan. So you ask, especially girls, you ask, you like this song? Oh, I love that song. Oh, no, they sing along with it. What's the name of the band who did it or the artist? Oh, I have no idea, but I really like that song. And that's the group's fault. That's the artist's fault that they didn't connect their image or their persona with the song. They were just elevator music. When you hear the music in an elevator, you have no emotional connection with who did it. It's just background noise. But my first music that I heard and fell in love with was black music. Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Fats Domino, that stuff before the Beatles. And that's also what they listened to. You know, when you hear the Beatles going, woo, 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 you know, all that stuff, that's all Little Richard and the Chuck Berry licks and all that stuff. In fact, ironically, even though it's the first music I heard as an 8.5-year-old kid, I was honored to have been asked by the Berry family to do the eulogy at his funeral.
How did the influence for Kiss, how did you guys get so much heavier? Because I feel like you guys are always thought of as one of the earlier really heavy rock bands. And you were listening to the Beatles, but was it the influence of Slade and purely the gear that you guys were buying, the Marshall amps, and was that the impact on it? How did the sound actually evolve to become heavier than the bands you just mentioned?
Well, at the core of it, we were still writing ABA kind of music. It means here's the verse, that's the A. Then you have your bridge, your pre-chorus. And you may go back to the verse, but then, you know, before long, you want to get to the chorus. So that's different, for instance, than Led Zeppelin, one of our favorite bands, of course. You'd have a song like Black Dog. The riff was the star, not the vocals. So you have a song like Black Dog, where the words Black Dog never show up in the song. It's just an ethereal kind of connection. And I, to this day, I have no idea what Black Dog is about, but who cares? The star is, it's the riff. And so there are different ways of doing stuff, but our Paul's and my songwriting influences were certainly the Beatles, but more generally, we were Anglophiles. We were huge fans of what the English were able to do with the thing that Americans invented, which is rock and roll and blues and jazz and, rockabilly and all the variations thereof, all invented in America. But while America gave the world the Grateful Dead, the English gave us, everybody. Nothing we ever gave the world gets close to the Beatles, the Stones, I don't know, Pink Floyd and Queen, and it just goes on and on. Even though we invented the music, what they did with the music was take it to heights that the Americans never had. And to this day, the coolest bands have always been the English bands.
That's right. Gene, there's a story of you guys flying to Japan, walking off the plane in kiss makeup, having to take it off because you had to go through customs and they wouldn't let you in with the makeup on, and then putting the makeup back on before you walked out of the airport so nobody would see you guys without the makeup. And I've heard you say it takes 2 hours plus to put the makeup on. This sounds like such a pain in the ass. Was it a pain in the ass to be constantly putting the makeup on your entire career? Or was it a ritual? Or what was it like? Howard Stern, you guys did Howard Stern at 6 a.m. You must have woken up at 3 a.m. to put the makeup on. Was it always that hard?
Yeah, but when you're having the time of your life and leading the kind of life you never imagined could happen, it bears noting that the air is much thinner on top of Mount Olympus. The most comfortable, stress-free kind of life is just to be, a regular guy walking down the street. No pressure, no stress, nobody's expecting anything from you. Happy-go-lucky kind of stuff. You want to be not ordinary, but extraordinary? Well, you're going to be judged. People are going to look at you. They're going to judge you. A lot of stress. It bears noting, by the way, that in 1977, when Kiss first went to Japan, we were so big, although we didn't know, that we broke in advance, we broke the Beatles' attendance record when they went there at the height of their fame. They say largest arena in Tokyo was Budokan. And I think 11,000, something like that. And they played either three or four shows. We played one more. And that was big news over there. And so when we went to Japan, and you can look this up on Google and Schmoogle, we actually had a 747, which was then the largest jet in the skies, Pan Am, Kiss Clipper, the entire 747 had us and about 100 journalists, and we all flew over together. And it was like this big story, and everything you described when we landed, our then manager, Bill Accoin, said, okay, we have an hour here on the tarmac. They gave us police approval and all that. Put on your makeup and your outfits because there are going to be a few thousand fans at the airport. And we went, what? Oh, yeah, they were all there. So we walk into the police and so on who are taking a look at our passports. And just as you describe it, they were, no. And we didn't know what was going on, but clearly the Japanese authorities didn't recognize our faces on the passports, and we had to go to an adjacent room, take the makeup off, show them it was us, and then go back in and put the makeup on. And what most people don't know is, just like the old Beatlemania things, they were a separate line of limos with a fake Kiss in them driving out to kind of try to fool the fans waiting out there, because we never saw anything that big. Well, we didn't fool everybody. And so the limos we were in, they were shaking us like a little roller coaster. It was kind of an amazing time.
The thing that I've never understood, and I've listened to many interviews to try to figure it out, Gene, Neil Bogart, even Neil, did not like the makeup and everything. He thought it would make you guys look, you know, whatever. And
silly.
You silly. And you said to him that nobody questions Superman and how he looks. But the thing that I don't get is just why was any of this even worth it? I mean, hindsight tells us all everything. But I have never been able to wrap around how this seemed like such a good idea other than looking back in hindsight. And even you guys say you don't even know who had the idea for the makeup. I just don't understand it, how it happened.
You know, scientists talk about stuff like that. They call it a singularity. It just happens. And the first people who became fans of the band were, strangely enough, the band. When we just bizarrely decided, all four of us, we were in a rat trap on 10 East 23rd Street, putting the band together, writing these songs and rehearsing and so on, with Ace and Peter. And one of us, I can't recall who, said, hey, let's go down to, I think it was Walgreens, one of these supermarket things where you can buy anything. Let's buy clown makeup and stuff and, you know, see what it looks like. And I have no idea why all of us went, yeah, that's a good idea. So we went downstairs, bought $15 worth of stuff, which in those days was a lot of money. We actually bought a few mirrors that were about 4 feet high, but longer than they were wider. So as you lean the mirrors against the wall, they would warp. So the closer you get to it, your nose would grow big, and the farther you get, your ears would pop out, you know, just bit like a freak house. And I remember, you're talking about early 73, 1873. That's a joke. And we just started putting makeup on without anybody saying anything. And as we were turning around to look at each other, it was like magic time. It was like, wow, that's cool. Like, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? It was all very, you know, you can think with your mind, and then it's got to make sense. Or you can act with your heart, which often doesn't make sense. And it was a matter of the heart, because logically, if you took a look at it, why would you risk being so strangely different than all the other bands? But even before Acceptance, we didn't have a record deal. We didn't even have a manager. We were in this rat-infested loft, no windows, nothing. And just somehow, I don't know what to tell you, it just happened. And we were convinced of it. We were blindly convinced of it, despite the fact that the professionals, the fans always knew. As soon as they saw us, they went, wow, who's this? But people who were in the industry always had points of views, because their reference point was Tony Orlando and Don or John Denver or whoever was popular at that point. And this was different.
What was the earliest form of pyro that you guys had? Was it just, you know, anything, or how, you know, professional was it early on?
Very dangerous. They were flash pods, which was gunpowder in metal tubes, which would scare the bejesus out of you, because they were really loud and very unsafe. You'd have to be, I don't know, 5 feet away from them, because sometimes there'd be debris, and we weren't experts in any of that stuff. So depending on how much gunpowder you put in there, the bigger the boom. And I recall early on a few, you know, two or three of those original flash pods. They were metallic and they were circular, about the size of, I don't know, a big pipe, and about, ooh, 4 or 5 inches in height. And the booms were so loud that they actually cracked these 1/8 of an inch thick metal flash pods. And the fireballs, you know, in those days, we could make them as big and as tall as we want. Fire marshals never showed up, and I was spitting fire on stage and throwing explosives over the audience's heads. Fire marshals never showed up. They didn't even know about it, because other bands, nobody had done that.
Was there a time when they started to show up, though? Or and how,
oh, yeah.
how would you coordinate
Oh,
the
yeah.
explosions? Would a roadie just fire them on cue, or was there even coordination to it?
Yes, early on, we hired, I don't know, about six guys. Four of them would crank the early machinery that would make Peter Criss's drum riser magically start to go up. Of course, they were backstage just cranking this thing. And we actually had a pyro guy who was probably suffering from explosion stuff. You know, when you come back from war, you twitch a lot because of all those booms. And again, because there were no safety measures or guidelines, it just sort of did it. But as soon as we started to get media and press, yeah, the fire marshal started to show up and ask questions. What do you mean you're going to do? What do you mean there's fire? Where's there fire? And then we, before the shows, throughout our career, we'd have to show them, here's what we're going to do. Gene's going to spit fire here. Here's what it looks like and all that. Yeah.
And you learned that at a magic shop, how to do that? Some guy just showed you in a magic shop how to spit fire, and you were the only one who volunteered to take on that role?
Kind of a stupid thing. We were in our manager's office because he was actually a television producer. He produced the original Supermarket Sweep and another show called Flipside that was on NBC. And I remember sitting on the sofa, all four of us, like the Four Stooges, and he introduces a guy, I think his name might have been Amazo, the Amazing Amazo, something like that. Magician kind of guy, completely bald on top with a Van Dyke beard. And O'Coin, the manager, said, hey guys, check this out. And in O'Coin's office, this guy, I don't know, turned his face around and then he spit fire, a big one. And the fire singed the ceiling. And we all went, what the hell? He goes, and it was O'Coin's idea. Okay, one of you guys is going to spit fire during the shows, during the song called Firehouse. And we all went, yeah, cool, yeah, yeah. And I thought he said, which one of you, let me get this right, doesn't want to do it?
No, are you serious?
Yeah, and I didn't hear him right. What he apparently said was, who wants to do it? And my hand shot up. Could very well have been Paul or Ace or anybody else. I thought he said, okay, who doesn't want to do this? And I shot my hand up. I said, okay, Simmons, you're going to be the guy that's going to do that. And he went, wait, what?
Why would he have asked that? Nobody even talks like that. That's what you thought he said?
He was very eloquent. You know, he spoke in very enunciated, and sometimes his sentence structure was certainly different than most people. Yeah.
And you said, oh, crap. And
yeah.
He taught you how to do it.
Too late. And then there was later on, a few years later on, there was a thing where I flew up for years on piano wire to the top of the light system. That was originally designed for Paul Stanley, and he's afraid of heights, always been afraid of heights, so he wouldn't do it. So the manager turns around again and says, okay, Simmons, you got to do that. Wait a minute. Yeah.
Gene, there is so much Kiss collectibles out there, so many Kiss collectibles out there. What are the most valuable collectibles? Is it like if you have mint comic books, or are those the most valuable? What's the most expensive stuff out there with Kiss's name on it?
The most valuable Kiss memorabilia is me.
Right, of course. But the plastic stuff.
I thought I was being clever.
No. Of course we know that. But second to you, Gene, is it the comic books, or who knows? We have no idea.
Tough to say. There have been thousands. You want me to do the joke that I've done for many years?
Well, give me the joke. Is it about the coffins?
The condoms and the caskets.
We'll get you coming and we'll get you going, right?
That's right. But the funny thing about that is we actually did make millions of condoms, and the caskets were also very successful. In fact, Dimebag Darrell's last wish in his will that he be buried in a Kiss casket. In fact, Dimebag showed us above his heart, he had a He had Ace Frehley tattooed right on his chest. Yeah.
And he was buried in a Kiss coffin?
Yes, he was.
Oh my
In
God.
In fact, I had a few in my collection. Probably the largest Kiss collection, although there are other fan collections that are right up there. And I took one of mine and sent it to his family.
Wow. The saying holds up. The saying holds true.
Yeah, I don't
Unbelievable.
know anything more than that.
Unbelievable. Gene, what do you think are your best bass lines? The one that I'm specifically really curious about is Detroit Rock City. That is such a funky bass line. Did Bob Ezrin work with you on that? Did you just come up with the kind of fills in the verse?
On Destroyer.
On Destroyer, yeah.
Yes, I know, I know.
Yeah.
A Destroyer, unlike any other record that we ever did, Ezrin had a big hand in arranging and suggesting parts. As an example, the middle of Detroit Rock City is a guitar solo, not so much a solo, but kind of a theme. Ba-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da, which almost sounds flamenco-ish, doesn't sound like blues. And so when we were rehearsing Detroit Rock City, Ezrin literally came in and he turned to Ace and says, okay, the guys are going to stop playing chords and we're just going to have the drums going and you're going to play this. Ba-da-da-da-da. And he hummed the actual note for note, including the harmony. That was all Ezrin. And then he said, Gene, how about this? I said, wait a minute, that's Freddy's Dead by Curtis Mayfield. And he goes, ba-dum-bum, 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 da-da-da-da-da, which is part of the bass riff. And it certainly isn't rock, and we certainly didn't fool around with funky stuff. And yet, there it is. That was Bob Ezrin's idea, unlike any other record. I mean, more Detroit Rock City than almost any of the songs, any of the rest of the songs. But on that one, it's Ezrin all over it.
How did you guys make the decision as a band to tune everything down a half step? Was that obvious, or was that like a revelation?
Well, unlike other bands, we were running around on stage on 7 and 8 inch platform heels, and the weight and the physicality of doing this stuff, you're constantly out of breath. I don't know if you saw early videos of stuff, all those moves, the back and forth and the stuff. And, you know, it was a very physically demanding show. And so what we started to notice, and you're screaming, you know, you're trying to push. And we noticed early on that our voices started to go. If you tune A440, which musicians will understand, it's the higher key that's predominantly. So if you say the E string, there is an actual E note. And so we started to detune half a step down. So all the strings on the guitar went up, but we all went down half a step so we could reach the high notes. And by the time we quit, we actually tuned down a full step. So an E was actually a D. So if you tried to play along, I mean, we would be playing on our instruments an E chord, but if you tried to play along with us, you'd notice that we were actually playing D.
Right.
I know people don't understand what that means, but yes, we detuned the instruments so that our voices wouldn't break.
Don't you think it gives the instruments a little bit of a different sound, or makes them sound a little bit darker, maybe?
It does.
It definitely does, I think, right? I mean,
well, not only
yeah.
we started doing that before there was a thing called, quote, metal, or, you know, the Seattle stuff. We just did it to save our voices, and then it became commonplace. So when you hear Metallica and everybody else, they're detuned because it sounds,
Van Halen,
you know, thicker and bigger. Oh, yes, I know that band.
Right. Were they detuned when you first saw them? They must have been, right? Or were they not?
I didn't know it originally because there's just Eddie and just one guitar, one bass. And I didn't, it's a funny story. Van Halen was first, after I produced their demo and all that, they were signed to me exclusively. But of course, then they got a record deal and all turned out well. And they're headlining Nassau Coliseum for the first time. And I'm backstage and actually off in the car. There was Joey Ramone and, some other people who wanted to check them out. And Eddie's got the guitar around his neck and they don't go on for another 15, 20 minutes. So I said, Eddie, let me see that guitar. Because Eddie put that guitar together, glued on the neck that he liked to a certain body. It was kind of like a Frankenstein monster put together. And so when I put it around my neck and tried playing a chord, it was completely out of tune. And I'm not exaggerating. I said, hey, you better go and tune this up before you hit the stage. You go, oh, no, man, don't worry. He put the guitar on his shoulders and then played a chord and bent the neck in tune. So that neck had some movement on it. And anybody else playing that instrument would sound horrible on it. And yet, when Eddie played on it, it sounded perfectly in tune.
God, that's crazy.
It sure is.
It's when the Replacements covered Black Diamond. Did you guys think that was cool, or were you not into it, or like, do
Oh,
you remember
sure. Oh, sure. I
which
mean,
one?
we were getting tapes, and even before social media, people sent us Nirvana later on doing Do You Love Me? And Van Halen used to do Firehouse and some other stuff. Metallica would sometimes do Detroit Rock City when they played Detroit, and just a lot of bands. And even this past tour, Green Day would close their show with Rock and Roll All Night. It's been an amazing ride, and of course, appreciated anybody giving us the time of day, much less deciding to step up and do one of the tunes. But truthfully, the reason you get in a band is not, I think I'm speaking for all the guys and bands, is not that you hope some other guys and other bands do your stuff. You want to appeal to your fans. And anything else above that, oh, that's cool. That's sort of, oh, I appreciate that kind of a thing. In fact, I'm so deluded about stuff that our tribute record, Kiss My Ass, I put that together and decided to sell the idea. I'll take credit for that one to Universal, that was called Polygram then, and convinced them there should be a Kiss tribute album and made the calls myself to all the artists. And we had many more than showed up on the record. I think Paul got in touch with Garth Brooks. And who else? I mean, if you want to have a party, why would you wait for somebody else to throw it? Throw your own goddamn party for yourself. That was the idea of Kiss My Ass,
I
the
think you did
tribute
the
album.
most brilliant thing on that record with Stevie Wonder, because he came in and you start singing him a harmonica line, and then you say, "Wait a second, Stevie, you know what? Just do whatever you want." Isn't that what you did in that recording session?
Well, Deuce, Lenny Kravitz, when I spoke to him, I said, do any song you want. He says, I got to do Deuce because that's what I first heard as a kid and so on. In fact, funny story is you can look this up on Google. If you put in Lenny Kravitz and Gene Simmons makeup, the story goes Lenny was kicked out of school because he came in at 13 or so wearing my makeup. So again, it's so appreciated and humbled that anybody would give us the time of day, much less want to do one of the tunes. So when I spoke with Lenny, sent the 24-track master, which had to be mixed. So I spoke to him before it was mixed, and I said, anything else you want there? Just want to make sure you're happy. He goes, yeah, I'd like Stevie Wonder to play harp on it. I go, you want Stevie? I had met Stevie before in the Diana Ross days, and she and I were going out together, but I wouldn't stand on ceremony. I just pick up the phone and call anybody for no reason. That's how I wound up writing songs with Bob Dylan, of all people. But getting back to the story, call up Stevie, and he immediately, so gracious, and so kind. Okay, you know, which studio? I'll be there and all that. So he shows up, and I'm going to try to, most of the stuff was me telling him stories about what a big fan I was. I was in the studio at Electric Lady when he wrote, when he was recording Superstition. Very Superstition. That was originally written for the Jeff Beck group. In fact, Beck was in the studio. And it was, I don't know, for whatever reason, Stevie decided to do the song himself. And I was telling him the stories and all that. Okay, time to record. So Stevie literally said something like, what do you want me to play? And I'm going, I wouldn't have the balls to tell Stevie Wonder what to play. And he, I don't remember the exact phrase. No, come on, man. What do you hear? And I just hum something, you know. You know, some bluesy kind of thing. Okay. And he just did it like that, first time. Like that, like note for note. It was unbelievable. And when Lenny heard it, he was just, wow. Yeah.
Do you ever, when you're around brilliance like that, do you ever think, maybe you feel like you could do that, or do you ever wish that you could take up a harmonica and just rip something, or do you feel like you said earlier that you have all the skills you need and you're very self-aware of where your strengths and shortcomings are, or are you intimidated being around such an amazing musician like Stevie Wonder?
You know, either you're the things in your head are either sounds and musical sort of compositions that are easier to play, or you have a jazz head, or, you know, some of the real shredders, you know, that kind of stuff. And when you have that stuff in your mind, your ability to play the instrument has got to be way up. But by and large, the music that I heard in my mind was a lot simpler than that. So a lot of the early demos, I played all the instruments, Dr. Love and, you know, things like that. Keyboard, 15, 16, that's me on keyboards. Drums, bass, guitar stuff, because sometimes I couldn't, the guys weren't available. Like when we recorded Christine 16 as a demo, the rest of the guys in the band weren't around, so I called up Alex and Eddie Van Halen, and they popped into the studio, and they recorded the track with me as a trio, and then I overdubbed keyboards on top of that and sang all the harmonies and all that. But, you know, the songs are not very complicated, so I can get by on drums, I can get by on keyboards, understand enough out of it, but not a solo, not a soloist by any means on that. I play guitar well enough to write songs and some solo stuff. So on, even on Kiss records, some of the stuff you think is Ace or Paul is actually me. And sometimes, you know, Ace would play the bass or Paul might. We didn't stand on ceremony. So Almost Human and War Machine, that's me doing the riffs. And on World Without Heroes, that's Paul playing the solo, not Ace. By the way, our favorite band, the Beatles, were just like that. When you hear Taxman and you hear that fabulous solo, that ain't George Harrison. That's Paul McCartney.
Right. Gene, we're wrapping up here. Is rock and roll still dead?
It is. And people don't understand how I can say that when we all have our favorite songs and we love our favorite bands, you and I and everybody else. But what I mean is that, well, let's play a game, and I've done this before. From 1958 until 1988, that's 30 years. 30 years. So what came during that period? Well, we had Elvis, we had the Beatles, the Stones, Jimi Hendrix, all that, Pink Floyd, the solo artist, David Bowie, and just music that lasts forever, we'd like to think. In the disco world, you had Madonna, more heavy guitars, you had, oh, God, I don't know, AC/DC and everybody else, Aerosmith and on, and you had Motown at the same time, you had Prince. You know, it was a very, very rich musical menu. It could go up and down. You had prog bands, you had Yes, Genesis, Gentle Giant, and you had the heavy bands, Led Zeppelin, and so on. And from 1988 until today, It's something like almost 40 years, certainly 35 years. Who are the new Beatles?
I mean, I could give two, maybe three. That's
Go
it.
ahead.
Nirvana.
Stop. We are blinded. I'm a major fan.
Yeah.
If you walked down the street and asked a 20-year-old, who's the bass player in Nirvana, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. Or can you sing a Nirvana song? No, no. The Beatles and, to a slightly lesser extent, the Stones and Elvis, everybody knew the Beatles. If you hated rock music, you knew about them. By the way, I'm delusional enough to believe some market reports about how the Kiss faces are the most recognized faces on the planet. And I've tried this before. You walk down the street, randomly ask people, who's on Mount Rushmore? They'll say, Elvis. They won't get it, but they know those four faces anywhere you go. They may hate the band, but you can't deny that. So Nirvana, one of my favorite bands. If you ask somebody who's 20 or something, there's a generation gap. Name a song. They wouldn't be able to tell you. Who's the bass player? No idea. And by the way, I know that because one of the other samples is my son, who's no longer that age, when he was a little bit over 20, saw a cute girl. He's telling me the story. So a cute girl, so he's trying to open up the conversation. And she's wearing a Rolling Stones t-shirt that's got the tongue on it. And on top of the t-shirt, it actually says The Rolling Stone. And he walks up and his first line is, oh, so you're a fan, huh? And she says something like, yeah, of what? And Nick, my son, says, you know, the Stones. She goes, the Stones? He goes, yeah, the Rolling Stones. She goes, the Rolling Stones? What's that, a band? Nick says, are you kidding? You're wearing their t-shirt. And he was telling me she looked down, you know, upside down, I guess, because it's facing. And she goes, oh, I just like the shirt. I just like the t-shirt. And Nick said, you must know the Rolling Stones. You know, Satisfaction, bam, bam, la, da, da. Nope, never heard it. He went through a few other songs, never heard those songs. And he said, you've never heard of Mick Jagger? And she said, Mick Jagger? Oh, yeah, I heard. What I'm about to tell you, my hand to God, is true. No exaggeration. She goes, Mick Jagger? Oh, yeah, the serial killer. Everything you
he
think.
He ended up marrying that girl, right? No, I don't know.
Never did. But anything you think is commonplace that the masses know, they don't. Very few things everybody knows.
Okay, that being said, though, Gene,
what were the other two bands?
Oh, the other two bands I was going to say are the biggest bands: Pearl Jam,
Not On Your Life,
and Foo Fighters.
You're of course. I love Foo Fighters. Love those bands. Mike McCready told me he was growing up with those Kiss records. In fact, one of his solos is, which he took note for note from Elvis, from Ace Frehley. But that's not my point. My point is, if you randomly walk down the street and you ask the first young person you meet, 20-year-old, and you say, name me anybody in Pearl Jam. Good luck with that. Name me or tell me a song. Hum a song they do. You and I are blinded because we're very close to it. So here's something the rest of the world knows, but we don't. Who's the Prime Minister of England? Tell me who the Prime Minister of France is. Tell me who the Prime Minister of Canada is. And by the way, next to Pearl Jam and Nirvana, strangely, Dave Grohl has become far more popular. They may know Dave because he's done TV commercials and sort of rubbed shoulders with people outside of guitars and concerts. That's how you get to be iconic. So if I say Snoop Dogg, everybody knows who that is. But if you mention other rappers who might actually be bigger rap stars, MC Criminal or whatever, I just made that up, the masses wouldn't have any idea. It's because Snoop plays in media, had a TV show with Martha Stewart and that kind of thing. So the masses have no idea who's in Phish, one of my favorite bands, or Pearl Jam. They wouldn't have a clue unless you're a fan. And by the way, one of the biggest bands ever is ABBA. Ask anybody, well, I'll ask you. Name the two girls in ABBA.
Oh, I could have named the two guys. What's his name? I can't name the girls.
That's my point.
It's a fair point, Gene. But what about Taylor Swift? Or is the point
the
that she's not rock?
The biggest artist of all time. And well-deserved, say I. Are you near a computer?
I'm on a computer.
Do you have a cell phone nearby?
I have a cell phone next to me.
Okay, open up the cell phone, go to Google, put in Taylor Swift, Keith Urban, Kiss Band.
Oh, I've seen this. Taylor Swift pranks Keith Urban. She came on dressed as Kiss.
The whole band did.
The whole band did. Because everyone loves Kiss.
Well, even if you hate it, not everybody loves Jesus either. That's not the point. Fame itself is the ultimate reward. Everybody's not going to like you, but they know you. We have a photographer who's been with us for, I don't know, 40 or 50 years, and he's done everybody, the Stones and Zeppelin, everybody. And he's a real music aficionado, collects posters and stuff. He hates the Beatles, always has. Can't stand listening to them. But he knows who they are, John, Paul, George, Ringo. Yeah. You know who Jesus is. Not everybody likes him, even the people that hate the idea of it. They've heard of the name and they know who he is. Fame is the ultimate reward.
Gene, I'm wrapping up here with this last question. You guys in Kiss are part of that group of people that you mentioned from the 50s into 88 or whatever the exact year was. You are literally on there is no discussion of rock and roll without Kiss. Do you acknowledge that, and does that feel real, or do you almost feel removed from it, and is it hard to put yourself in those shoes?
I don't want to say this for effect, and I've said this before, and the feedback is, you're full of it. Well, I may be full of it, but none of that means anything to me. It really doesn't. I also don't have a thing about things, material wealth. You know, I certainly enjoy money, and I always want to make more of it, but it's not because it can buy me things. It's because it gives you security and freedom. But buying things does not appeal to me. Also, credibility means nothing to me. Nothing. Because credibility is a small group of people, often in New York or LA or London, you know, major cities, who sit around critics, who sit around writing lists and making these things up, and are not connected to the great unwashed masses. Just like this, the first time the current president ran for president, everybody, every CNN, but everybody thought, no question, Hillary Clinton will beat the pants off and everything. She's the next. Every poll. And I remember watching CNN and Wolf Blitzer. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an upset, the likes of which we've never seen before, despite the fact that the thing, and then state after state, and he beat the pants off her. And by the way, all the polls yet again were showing that Kamala Harris, I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're in, but all the polls said she was going to win. She not only lost, but she lost by a lot. And by the way, she lost the popular vote and the Electoral College. So what the political pundits or the critics say, there is only one judge and jury, and those are the masses. That's all there is. Because they don't have a vested interest. They're not political. They're not trying to be cool. They live in places like Ypsilanti, Michigan, where you're not trying to impress somebody with your new Rolex watch or whatever the latest thing is. New York and LA are affected. All the stars live in New York. All the big financial people live in, sorry, all the stars live in LA, and all the big financial people live in New York. And if you're a country person, you all live in Nashville, you know, you can make these generalizations are true. But if you're away from those cities, these are the people, the great masses, which we all have to buckle our knees to, whether you're the Pope or a political figure or a rock band. You live and die by whether or not the masses love you, not by whether or not critics love you. Let me put it another way. I would rather be Chicago than the Ramones.
Why?
I know it sounds... Well, the Ramones may have one gold record to their name. And by the way, I love the Ramones.
But they made
but
no
we're
money.
not we're, hold on.
Yeah.
They have, maybe they have one gold record, and they never played arenas, and they certainly never played a stadium. Chicago had 22 multi-platinum albums in a row. That's more than the Beatles. Ramones get all the credibility. It's a critic's band. Chicago gets no credibility. So you have to decide what you're doing this for. You know that Nirvana was always credible beyond, and just, you know, the drama and the unfortunate suicide of Kurt and all the rest of that. Dave Grohl came from the same band. Foo Fighters is, well, arguably five times the size and popularity of Nirvana. They never played a stadium. Grohl and the boys certainly have, and in London played two sold-out Wembley stadiums. Would you rather be in Nirvana or Foo Fighters? The question is, who are the judges? Who do you court? Critics, I think they mean well, but they're the most unqualified people on the planet. They've never done anything. They have no resume and no experience. They just have opinions. I think that's a fair assessment. Now, critics get lots of music and a lot of things. They've got, it's a job. They've got to go through all this stuff. But people who love music love it because it connects to their heart. The masses have the credibility I want because they only love the music they love, right?
That's the name of the game right there, especially for you guys.
Absolutely. Well, not only do they love the music they love, they prove it by reaching into their hard-earned wallets and taking out money, and they vote with money. Critics get free records.
Gene, it was great talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
I want you to know you have friends out there.
It seems like it.
Yes, people like you, and I wish you the best of luck, and I hope when you become the biggest whatever you want to be on the planet, I'll be able to, you know, nudge somebody and say, oh yeah, I know him.
Back at you, Gene. That means a lot, and thank you so much for taking the time on short notice, and I hope we get to do it again.
Thank you. I wish you well.